Article 1 of the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights states that all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood. You're listening to the Article 1 podcast. I'm Eric Tanner. In both our podcast and magazine editions, we've dedicated to reporting on human rights issues from a variety of perspectives. This series is produced as part of the Community Podcast Initiative on Treaty 7 territory and powered by Shaw. In this episode, we'll examine solutions surrounding the insidious issue of Calgary's food insecurity. Food insecurity is the lack of accessibility to a reliable and affordable meal source. Despite being largely cast off as a problem affecting third world countries, it is a major concern within the city, even if its communal impacts may not be as explicitly apparent. The stagnation of income, coupled with the monetary inflation of food products, has left many Calgarians feeling priced out and finding it difficult to secure healthy and sustainable meals for themselves and their families. This issue has only been exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. However, this has led to a few grassroots initiatives popping up, with hopes to solve this deceptive and widespread problem. To discuss this issue, I reached out to Julie Van Rosendahl, food editor for the Globe and Mail and best-selling cookbook author. She touched on how food insecurity impacts all Calgarians, who is the most vulnerable, and potential community solutions the city could facilitate. I spoke with Julie remotely from her kitchen in Ramsey, Calgary, which resides on Treaty 7 territory. So my first question for you is, in your brief definition, what is food security?
Food security is when you feel secure in your food supply. You know, I have never had to worry about where my next meal comes from. And so I don't live with food insecurity. And so those who live with food insecurity don't, like I said, don't have a secure source of food. They, you know, in terms of food supply, ability to prepare it, ability to feed themselves and their families. Mm-hmm. It's a growing concern in Canada, even, where we have plenty of food. We shouldn't have a problem with food insecurity. Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of touched on it there, but how is food security and the issue of availability affecting Calgarians in their everyday lives?
Oh boy. Well, you know, affordability is an issue, and it's, you know, becoming more of an issue with rising food costs. Although, you know, in Canada in general, we spend less of our incomes on food than most of the rest of the world. So food is relatively cheap in North America. But you know, it's not only affordability, it's access, it's education, it's knowing how to prepare the food that is available. Access has been an increasing issue throughout the pandemic, when situations like floods occur, when there are you know, food distribution interruptions, as we saw with the floods in BC more recently. But yeah, food security can mean, you know, affordability, it can mean access, it can mean a lot of things. And yeah, I mean, there are a lot of organizations and agencies and individuals addressing it in Calgary. There are, you know, issues with food security in schools. There are all kinds of problems with food distribution and food affordability, with the cost of food going up, with restaurants closing and reopening and having a hard time with staffing. And that's leading to more job insecurity with young people, which, you know, in turn, there's like a domino effect. Yeah, I mean, it's affecting people's ability to feed their families and for kids to concentrate at school and for people to you know, have energy to work throughout the day. So it's affecting people in a lot of ways.
And you kind of touched on this the previous question, but mm-hmm. if you've noticed, how has the food insecurity problem been exacerbated by the pandemic?
Oh boy. You know, a lot of it has had to do with access, you know, when schools closed, in March of 2020 that cut off kids from a key source of food over the course of their days. There are a lot of, you know, supports available for adults, but not a lot available for kids. So that was a big one. You know, most school communities see some level of food insecurity in the kids that attend their schools, and some schools are higher than others, have higher need than others, have, you know, different areas of the city. During the pandemic, we've seen a lot of job losses. We've seen a lot of people losing their incomes. CERB coming in did a lot that, you know, that showed that having a basic income helped a lot of people, and a lot of organizations saw the need kind of plateau early on because people did have a source of income. They could go and buy food. We saw a lot of organizations, sort of pivot to gift cards, so that people could go shopping and buy what they need and choose, you know, what they need to feed their families. That's something that's not available to kids. So again, the kids in the city were really cut off from a big support of food at schools between breakfast and lunch programs, emergency food programs, and all the clubs, right? All the youth groups, the recreation centers, all those sort of outreach programs that served kids in different ways, but also offered food supports on the side. The pandemic has really shown a lot of issues in, you know, where we could do better in terms of food security. There's a lot of financial support that came from the pandemic that went out to, you know, to address food insecurity by sending, you know, grants, sending financial support to agencies and organizations. So that was good to see.
And so just to transition, kind of, we've talked about a lot of the negatives of food security, but there have been a lot of like solutions I've noticed in grassroots initiatives to kind of tackle this issue. And I'd kind of like to touch on that next. So what is being done to help alleviate issues of food security and accessibility around in the city that you've noticed?
There are a lot of organizations that have been around for a long time. There are a lot of new programs that try to rescue food and sort of redirect it to people who could use it. So there are apps in place, or places like the Leftovers Foundation. There are a lot of organizations and a lot of sort of more grassroots community initiatives, some of which I've been a part of, that try to address need in their communities. And a lot of schools, public schools, have their own needs. So some of them have food banks, you know, in their schools, or try to address the needs of their school communities in different ways.
And you said you were a part of a couple of these initiatives. Which were those?
I have worked with most of the hunger-related agencies in Calgary, you know, over the course of my life. During the pandemic, early on in the pandemic, when they closed schools, my first reaction was, you know, what's going to happen to all these kids who have been disconnected from their source of food at school with breakfast and lunch programs. And of course, the schools themselves, the school communities, are the access points for organizations like Brown Bagging, like Meals on Wheels, who have these programs that serve kids at schools. So early on, when, you know, the schools closed and there was also a surplus of food with the restaurants closing, with, SAIT, for example, Culinary Arts School, they ended up with 10,000 pounds of food, if I'm recalling correctly, that they had to redistribute. I had chefs, you know, calling me saying, what do I do with all this food? Coffee shops had all this milk. And I knew some teachers at Bowcroft School in Bowness who the Monday morning after they closed the schools were, you know, put the word out to their school communities that they would be in the parking lot at lunchtime, redistributing the food that was still in their school to the kids who they knew needed it and the families. And so, so I kind of connected with them really quickly and was helping redirect food to them to distribute to their communities. And that kind of snowballed into, we opened up the restaurant at Rouge. Of course, all the restaurants were closed at the time, and a bunch of local chefs, Paul and Ollie, who own Rouge, and then some state chefs. Andrew Hewson was there. I'm trying to remember all the chefs who were, it seems like so long ago all of a sudden. So we opened up the kitchen, and at first it was because there was all this food that was, everyone was trying to redistribute, and the agencies only had so much fridge space and so much capacity to receive this food and process it and distribute it to the people that they worked with. So we opened up the kitchen and started making lunches and distributing them at these sort of pop-up points, every day of the week, Monday to Friday. And we ended up having 13 distribution points throughout the city, with these pop-up lunch distribution. And we did hundreds of lunches, which was great. So it eventually, after a while, we raised some money and had a catering company take it over. So, you know, catering companies are often overlooked. All events were canceled at the time. Catering companies have huge kitchens, huge walk-in fridges and freezers, and often vehicles to deliver. So it made sense to work with Devour Catering. They took over the production of the lunches, and then the pickups were happening there at their, they have a big, backdoor loading dock. So people would come and pick up the lunches there. And so that was something that we did for a while. And then, you know, I started working with the food bank to try and get some of the surplus food that even the food bank has surplus food that they couldn't store or move, like potatoes, for example. We've seen a huge surplus of potatoes over the course of the pandemic because restaurants are closed, and, you know, so many French fries are made and served in restaurants. And so we've had this glut of potatoes. And then in PEI, they banned the export of potatoes before Christmas. So we sort of saw another wave of surplus potatoes. So the food bank was working with catering kitchens, and I believe there's three, they're still working with them to process some surplus food, and get it back to the food bank to distribute to places, that could use prepared meals. Because, you know, one big thing that, it doesn't often get addressed when it comes to food insecurity is not everybody has the means to turn whole ingredients into usable meals, right? So there's often the argument that people who are living with food insecurity should get, raw fruits and vegetables and whole foods. But even people who live with food security don't have the time or the means to, or the desire to make their meals from scratch every day, right? Mm-hmm. So often processed foods, you know, or packaged foods are frowned upon, but, you know, not everyone has even a kitchen to work with, kitchen tools, supporting ingredients, right? You might get a bin with potatoes and mushrooms and bananas and all these things, but you might not have cooking oil, you might not have stock, or, you know, all these different ingredients that you need to turn your food bank bin into a meal. So to have catering companies turn the ingredients into soup or scalloped potatoes or something that, you know, a shepherd's pie, something that people can just heat up and eat is amazing, but it also keeps those small businesses afloat, right? And I think that is key as well in terms of addressing food insecurity, is keeping the small businesses open, keeping people employed. And the hospitality industry employs so many of our young people. I believe it's 25% of young people work in hospitality. And so it benefits us to get those relief funds circulating through small businesses in Calgary. And it's hard for people to understand how that might look. But that's a perfect example, right? If you have the food bank with a lot of these relief funds, receiving a lot of these relief funds, for them to be able to partner with restaurants or catering businesses and have them able to pay their staff and keep them employed, and at the same time process food that might otherwise wind up in the compost, you know, that they don't have the ability to store or to distribute all of it, and turn it into food that's usable for people who live with food insecurity and who might not be able to have the time to cook. You know, a lot of people are working two jobs, they have families, they, you know, like I said, they might not have kitchen tools or, you know, the knowledge to cook. I mean, not everybody knows how to turn ingredients into a meal. I think that's a win for everybody.
Just to kind of build on that, are there any future innovations or advancements that could be implemented throughout the city to help harbor more food security that aren't implemented or really in action yet?
Oh my gosh, there's so many. So many ideas. I mean, I think a sustainable school lunch program is important and possible. And I've been talking with people within the CBE, just in, you know, my sister is a school principal. She has a lot of knowledge about, you know, need. And so I've talked to her a lot about it, but during the pandemic, I sort of pulled together some restaurateurs, some catering people, some teachers, and some friends who have actually studied food insecurity, and we've talked about how we might structure a sustainable school lunch program that utilizes restaurants and, you know, underused restaurants, underused catering kitchens, because we're not going to see it, you know, a return to events at the level that they used to be pre-pandemic anytime soon. And there are a lot of restaurant kitchens that are underused. They might be open for, you know, for lunch or only dinner. And so the kitchens are available in the mornings, for example. And so the idea is that we partner schools with community kitchens and generate sort of a more sustainable, you know, not a not-for-profit, but a social enterprise where all kids at a given school are offered the opportunity to get a lunch, because, you know, a lot of kids struggle with the idea of being identified as a child who might need an emergency lunch, and to have lunch available to all kids equally, nobody knows who's paying, who's not paying, if they're subsidized or they're not subsidized. I, as a parent, would love to have the option of, you know, paying $5 a day for my son to get lunch at school, and to have the option of subsidizing another child's lunch, you know, but if I knew I was paying into this program that was enabling all kids to have the option of a lunch and it was equal for all of them, because, you know, dignity is such a huge piece of it. And to have all kids, treated equally in terms of school lunch and, you know, and have it accessible to all of them and none of them know, you know, whose parents are paying for it, whether it's subsidized or not. It's just equal. It's just available to everybody. So I think that's something that could and should happen. And that's a model that could be repeated in other cities and other school districts, you know, across the country, because we're not going to have, you know, a federal school lunch program anytime soon to install full kitchens in all schools is not probably going to happen anytime soon. But I think looking at ways that we can engage the hospitality industry and tap into those underused kitchens to help feed people is important. You know, and when you look at how people are fed, there are different structures. There are places like, you know, the women's shelter or the drop-in center that have kitchens that have chefs, and they receive a lot of redirected food. A lot of those kitchens have closed during the pandemic. So, you know, so tapping into those restaurants or catering kitchens, you know, I know the Ronald McDonald House is another example of a kitchen that used to, I think they're back to having volunteers coming in, but it's been sort of on and off, right? As agencies haven't been able to work with volunteer bases, right? And we haven't had the corporate volunteer groups going into the places like the drop-in center or Ronald McDonald House to cook like they used to. So having tapping into to restaurants and catering kitchens to feed people in those, you know, residential situations, to help feed more people through places like the food bank. I think that, you know, that will see the redistribution of wealth of the relief funds, because a lot of the agencies have had huge surpluses in the last year because of all these relief funds. So getting those moving through the hospitality industry, I think, because once these restaurants close, and so many of them have closed or are on the verge of closing, once they close, they're probably not going to reopen. The profit margin in the restaurant industry is like 2-5% before the pandemic. And so, you know, they've really been hanging on by a thread. So to keep them going, and helping them be part of the solution, you know, to have a neighborhood, you know, small independent restaurants helping feed kids in schools, to go back to the school lunch issue, we'll have a more diverse, you know, culinary offerings for kids, having them be part of the solution, right? Having the community, restaurants in the community feed kids and feed other people in the community, I think is going to be key to getting through this and keeping them afloat.
Mm-hmm. And just before we finish it off, how can listeners help support food security efforts in their communities?
Oh boy. You know, I don't think it's always about writing a check. I think the key to getting through this is really paying attention to the people in our communities and how we can help, and trying to spot where the needs are and ask where, you know, ask. It's hard for people to ask for help, but it's easy for us to ask, you know, is there a need? All communities have schools. Most schools have some level of need. But just, you know, that our neighbors are, you know, seniors in our communities, sharing meals at a regular basis that you might have surplus, and dropping off meals with a neighbor who, you know, might be able to use it. Like, those little things are huge. And I think it's easy to become overwhelmed with this pandemic and the sense of, you know, how big the problem seemed to be. And, you know, we hear about increasing food costs, and we hear about supply chain disruptions, and they're all big problems that are causing, you know, these sort of ripple effects. But, you know, learning how to cook, learning how to use what we have, and, you know, cook more beans and grains and things that are affordable, and looking to our communities and recognizing where the need is and helping where we can, I think is the key to getting us through this.
Mm-hmm. All right. That's awesome. And just before we conclude, is there anything else you'd like to add? Anything that wasn't brought up that you'd like to speak on, or?
Oh, good question. It's such a big topic. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to I hope I made sense. I feel very rambly today.
No, you definitely did. You follow you're especially in the in the second half, some of your answers were just incredible. Like,
okay, good.
They were such good talking points, and I can't thank you enough for it. It was so good.
Oh, good. I was sort of thinking in terms of like addressing, you know, rising food costs and how to address it at home. And then like the whole food insecurity conversation is so big. Right. Mm-hmm. But I think we all have the ability to do more than we think we can, you know, and sometimes people have ideas and they don't act on them because they think they don't, you know, they're not sure how, but just doing it and learning as you go. And if you have an idea and you want to make it happen in your community, that's how people get fed, right? And opening up your community hall, working with your library, we started doing pop-ups at Calgary Public Libraries and thinking about these access points and thinking about kids and how a lot of them are left to their own devices, right? So how do you make food access easy for kids to find you? And, you know, because, you know, it's hard to assess the need as a community member, but we all sort of have different connections, right? You know, we're all part of Facebook groups and, you know, not all of us, but there's so many different ways to connect with our communities these days. And just paying attention, I think, is important. And remembering to sort of do it in a dignified way, you know, when it comes to reaching out to people in our communities and being there, and, you know, maybe it's having a cooking club or a lunch club at your school. There are just so many ways people have such great ideas, and I think they're becoming more tuned into the needs of their communities through this pandemic and more bold about acting on their ideas, which is so great. You know, people are just more open to it, and it's great to see.
That was Julie Van Rosendahl, freelance journalist and cookbook author from right here in Calgary. You've been listening to the Article One podcast. Thanks for tuning in. Article One is a human rights magazine published by Mount Royal University journalism students in Calgary, Alberta. You can find us online at article-one.ca. That's the number one. This series is produced as part of the Community Podcast Initiative and powered by Shaw. This podcast was produced on Treaty 7 territory, a region with a long tradition of storytelling, rich culture, and history. Since human rights are a universal issue, we're committed to elevating and including all voices, including First Peoples, as we continue our work. Thanks to artist Broke for Free for our theme. The song is Daybird off their Directionless EP. My name is Eric Tanner, and thank you for listening.